At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Elections in the EU, consolidation in the auto industry, and in climate change news, survival, plain and simple. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, May 27th, and thanks for being with us on this Memorial Day. We'll have more on what this day means to us a little bit later in the show, but we're starting off in Europe, where the EU just wrapped up parliamentary elections in several countries, including Britain, Germany, Italy, and France. Nationalist and populist parties have been on the rise, and pro-Europe voters turned out in huge numbers to counter them. For more, here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard. Stephen, thanks for being here.
Nice to talk to you, Molly.
So I know the media loves its storylines, but this was billed as no less than the battle for the soul of Europe.
Right.
Those who want this much closer union, the nationalists who want a looser collection of independent states. Sticking with the storyline idea, who won?
Not the nationalists. They didn't make the big breakthrough that many were expecting. Some of them did very well. I mean, Lega, the far-right Italian party, did very well. Marine Le Pen's party in France did well. But across the EU and in the European Parliament, these nationalist anti-EU parties are still in a minority. So they'll create a lot of noise going forward, but probably won't be able to disrupt the EU or seriously hinder moves towards greater integration.
What about, though, more on the nationalist side, the Brexit Party, which seemed to do very well in Britain? How much impact could that have then on European Parliament and the EU overall?
Well, it did extremely well, considering this party didn't exist 6 weeks ago. There's a Conservative Party leadership election about to start now that Theresa May is stepping down. And the Brexit Party's success could well persuade many Conservatives that they should follow the Brexit Party line and go for a clean break Brexit. However, it must be said, most British lawmakers are against a no-deal Brexit and could veto it. And if you add up the votes for all the parties that support Britain remaining in the EU, they outnumber the Brexit Party vote.
Well, and it seems like there is increasingly loud talk of a second referendum. How likely do you think that might be?
It does look increasingly likely that there might be a second referendum because these people who are arguing that Britain should remain in the EU have to deal with the fact that 3 years ago, 17.4 million Brits voted to leave the EU, and the result of that referendum has not yet been delivered. So maybe it will eventually have to go back to the people, but it remains a highly, highly contentious issue in British politics. Mm-hmm.
So I want to pivot a little bit. We've talked about tensions, of course, within the EU. I want to talk about economic tensions between the US and the European Union, specifically on auto tariffs. especially with a big proposed auto merger on the line today. The EU promised to reject the Trump administration push to limit imports of cars and parts from Europe. That's just happening today. What does that mean for the future of that trade relationship?
Well, this is potentially a very serious escalation. EU car makers' exports run into the tens of billions of dollars. I mean, it's actually, in fact, they're worth 10 times European steel and aluminum exports to the US. So the EU is determined to stand up to President Trump's threats, giving every impression today that the Commission has not been in any way weakened in its stance by the European election result.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, Molly.
Now let's explore that auto industry news I just mentioned there. Fiat Chrysler has reportedly proposed a merger with the French carmaker Renault. It would create the third largest automaker by production behind Toyota and Volkswagen Group. But at a time when automakers are laying off thousands of workers and expecting the global market to weaken, why try to get bigger? Marketplace's Andy Uhler explains that one.
If this deal comes to pass, the merger would vault this new company ahead of General Motors in production numbers, with the capacity for making almost 9 million vehicles a year. Right now, things are profitable for Fiat Chrysler, thanks in large part to Jeep and Ram truck sales in the U.S. But the demand for new vehicles in America and China appears to be slowing, so car makers are anticipating another downturn. Ed Niedermeyer is senior editor for mobility technology at TheDrive.com.
When the downturn comes, all of a sudden, your cost structure is too big for the amount of revenue that you're making on your sales.
So a merger could allow this company to combine production and maximize efficiency. Sam Fiorani at Auto Forecast Solutions says logistically this merger makes sense.
Because it allows Fiat Chrysler and Renault to merge in platforms and engine programs and consolidate a lot of costs.
But consolidation can mean job cuts, and the French government may look carefully at the deal with that in mind. If the deal does go through, though, this combined company would also fill in important gaps for Fiat Chrysler, especially in electric vehicle production. Again, Ed Niedermeyer.
Fiat Chrysler is just way behind and really doesn't even have a path to catch up with those markets as they develop.
Renault, on the other hand, has been investing heavily in EV technology research and development, thanks to a partnership with Nissan. It's still unclear who would actually run this combined entity, though. Renault is reportedly studying the proposal, but gave no timetable for a decision. I'm Andy Uhler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, markets are closed for Memorial Day. European markets seemed mostly relieved by the results of those elections. We'll have details of a different sort when we do the numbers. It is officially cap and gown season for college graduates, which means a few million people in their early 20s are hitting the job market. And it's a job market that hasn't been this good for young graduates since before the Great Recession, but with one stubborn problem. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
The National Association of Colleges and Employers reports companies plan to hire nearly 11% more graduates than last year. And, says research director Edwin Koch,
over 50% of graduating seniors that applied for a job have already gotten one offer, at least one offer.
That's the highest offer rate since 2007. But Koch says starting salaries have risen just 1.5% to 2% annually in recent years, hardly keeping up with inflation.
Computer science, specific engineering disciplines, those are seeing a little bit better increases.
But how significant is the starting salary?
Compensation is not the most important or not the main motivator for these candidates.
Ali Van Duren leads the campus recruiting practice at HR firm Korn Ferry, and she says new grads are more focused on opportunities to learn and grow with their new employer. Van Duren says this year's grads have the luxury to be choosy. That's especially true for the roughly one-third of students lucky enough to make it through debt-free, like Brett Wilson, who just graduated from Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon. She wants to go into marketing or HR. She got a merit scholarship and her parents paid the rest, which she says
gives me the opportunity to kind of follow through with any of my aspirations right now, even if it's lower paying.
Korn Ferry reports the average salary for class of 2019 grads nationwide will be $51,347. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Next to the job market in India. That country is the second biggest maker of footwear and leather garments. In fact, India accounts for nearly 13% of the world's production. Prime Minister Narendra Modi has promised to create more jobs in that industry with a manufacturing initiative called Make in India and a goal of increasing exports over the next 5 years by more than $3 billion. But the government has also cracked down on slaughtering cows. And as our BBC colleague Victoria Craig reports, that is causing hardship in the leather industry.
It's a scorching 100-degree day here in the heart of New Delhi at a market where shoppers are hunting for the best deals on leather goods. At a stall here, workers are unpacking boxes of leather bags, showing them to one shopper who's looking for something specific. But what's not visible to this bustling crowd is the hardship that's descended on India's domestic leather industry.
Our tanneries were established in 1902. Never in 117 years have we seen such an assault on industry.
That's Ashif Rizwan, owner of Omra Tanning Industries in the country's leather capital of Kanpur in Uttar Pradesh state. He runs four tanneries where hides from cows, goats, and buffalo are treated and turned into sheets of leather used for manufacturing products. He employs roughly 2,000 people, but with three of his units shut since December, Mr. Rizwan has had to lay off roughly three-quarters of his staff.
Our wooden tanning drums, worth more than $214,000, are being ruined because they're drying out from disuse. Our laid-off workers are destitute, and we've lost customers in Japan and the U.S. for whom we supply automotive leather.
In December, authorities ordered more than 300 tanneries in Kanpur to close for the Kumbh Mela, a Hindu festival on the Ganges River. This was expected and meant to keep industrial waste and sewage out of the river for the festival period. But 6 months on, tanneries are still banned from reopening.
It's political. The government wants to punish this industry because it's largely run by Muslims.
Leather is a culturally complicated issue in India, especially under the current Hindu nationalist government. And in an election year, it's common for politicians to mix political, cultural, and religious issues to energize their base. Gilles Vernet, assistant professor of political science at Ashoka University in Delhi, explains why an election is having such a big impact on the leather industry.
This sector of activity has come under great strain because of state policy that aim at protecting the cow, a strong, symbolically charged animal for Hindus in India. Vigilante groups have targeted those individuals in the name of cow protection. Individuals have been killed, individuals have been lynched or beaten up with tremendous consequences for the leather industry. You cannot simply exit the meat industry or the leather industry to invest elsewhere. You cannot close and sell your tannery. Who would you sell it to in the first place? And so people are trapped.
It's not just a domestic issue, though. The consequences may also ripple around the world and affect a treasured Indian export in markets abroad. Leather and thread are elements that have, for centuries, been used to craft products like bags, belts, and shoes the country has become famous for. Those two basic materials are also the English translation for the name of 8-year-old Indian goods company, Napadori, which has brought its country's heritage and nostalgia to global customers.
It's Indian artisanship with English architectural sensibilities.
Founder Gautam Sinha will give customers in London a taste of India in his soon-to-be-opened flagship store. While shoppers browse a range of leather goods crafted in India, they can also sip beverages like chai served in traditional clay cups. It's an exciting time for the company, even during a fraught period for the leather industry in India.
That's Victoria Craig from the BBC. coming up.
I do think that there is a certain risk if we start to focus primarily on Mars colonization.
What if we just skipped Mars and built colonies around the Earth instead? But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets are closed for Memorial Day. Let's look at some different numbers that reflect the spirit of the day, honoring those who died serving in the U.S. Armed Forces. The Department of Veterans Affairs maintains 136 national cemeteries in 40 states and Puerto Rico. The National Cemetery Administration is the Veterans Administration entity that oversees these sites. It manages about 21,400 acres within its cemeteries. More than 27,000 visitors usually come to Arlington National Cemetery on Memorial Day. The melody for Taps, the bugle call played at military funerals, has 24 notes. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Our next two stories are about climate change, what's happening now, and what needs to happen to survive its worst effects. The UN estimates that at current rates of warming, governments around the world will spend $54 trillion on cleanup, healthcare costs, and recovery from extreme weather events. On my show, Marketplace Tech, we're exploring how technology can help us adapt to a climate that's already changed. And that is going to require funding. Jay Coe is managing director of the private equity firm Lightsmith Group, which is investing in adaptation tech. Jay, let's start at the top. What does adaptation mean?
Yeah, so it's a great question. Most people may be familiar with the idea of mitigation, which is sort of a UNFCCC kind of Paris Agreement term for looking at reducing the rate at which we're producing greenhouse gases.
And so that, just to be clear, sorry, just to jump in and clarify, that means, you know, starting with renewables and electric cars and inclusive of maybe sucking carbon out of the air?
Sure. So what you do is you do things that are lower carbon or lower carbon intensity, like renewable energy. So you're buying energy and it's cleaner. So that's what's known as mitigation, sort of mitigating the scale of the problem that we're creating for ourselves in climate change. So adaptation is the idea that you need to begin to invest against those changes by finding the things that we use today to address those things and scaling them up dramatically, deploying them in different places as climate change moves around and making sure that we have the scale of the tool set needed to deal with a problem that is much larger and more complex. So, you know, I think part of the challenge here has been when most people try to imagine what adaptation means, they think of giant seawalls around Manhattan or putting domes over cities or some kind of futuristic Jerry Bruckheimer scenario. And the answer is, unfortunately, even if you wanted to do those things, you wouldn't know how to design those systems yet in a systematic way. And you may not have the technologies and products and solutions at scale to do those things.
And you've identified these 20 different areas, right, where there's going to be this need for new technology or more of existing technology. Can you tell me about some of them?
Yeah. So the entire economy basically is naked long climate risk. There aren't any hedging strategies yet for it. I mean, your house, your 401k.
Wait, hold on. Can you back up? What does that mean?
It means
naked
that
what now?
Naked long climate risk. So every single asset that exists is going to be affected to some degree, positively or negatively, by climate change. So adaptation is the idea that you need to begin to invest against those changes. And we think a first step in that is assessing what risk and impact is actually going to be changed by climate change, and also then beginning to address those changes and risk and impact by finding the things that we use today to address those things, to deal with a problem that is much larger and more complex in the future.
If you really play this scenario forward, based on the recognition that climate change is happening and will impact virtually everyone on Earth, that the business opportunity seems really profound.
First and foremost, we need to recognize that climate change is a humanitarian disaster. Mm-hmm. This is increasing loss of life. This is causing massive amounts of displacement. So there's a huge problem that we're just accelerating, not to mention the impact on biodiversity. In terms of the scale of opportunity, I'd actually make a stronger form argument, which is the current estimates and projections by the UNEP is that this may that the effects of climate change problem may cost up to $300 billion a year by 2030 in developing countries alone, and the estimates just keep getting larger. That kind of money is not available in public aid or government funding, and I'd say, in fact, that without being able to harness the flow of private capital, entrepreneurship, technology, investment, and action, from the private sector, we are going to face a much, much more challenging experience with the effects of climate change flowing through over the next several decades and potentially the next several generations. And I think there's great sources today on the upside of technology, analysis, entrepreneurship, innovation in the private sector that can be scaled up to help assess and address the problem.
Jay Coe is Managing Director of the private equity firm Delight Smith Group. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
You can find more of our stories from the Marketplace Tech series called How We Survive at our website, marketplace.org. And now to a fictional look at how climate change might kickstart not just our terrestrial economy, but our space economy too. By that, I mean the business of space exploration, mining, and creating human colonies on nearby planets or even in orbit. Science fiction author Daniel Suarez explores this topic in Delta V. It's a new book inspired in part by last year's UN report that said humans only have about 12 years to avert catastrophic climate change, and by the trend of private companies entering the space industry. Daniel Suarez, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
So right from the beginning in this book, the impetus for the space exploration that you set out is climate change. How much do you see, you know, migrating to space on some level as a way to adapt to the changing climate?
Well, I think it does bring a certain level of urgency to it. The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change stated that we had about 12 years before we started to face a climate catastrophe.
So do you see it as a bit of a roadmap? Because you've got some pretty specific ideas in here, including abandoning the idea of terraforming Mars. Let's start there. This is anti-Mars colony, which I think is a little idiosyncratic, perhaps, right now.
Well, let's talk through that. I do think that there is a certain risk if we start to focus primarily on Mars colonization, that's $300 to $500 billion and a great deal of time spent sending a few dozen people to another planet. And we really have to ask, what is the return on that? And I personally feel that near-Earth asteroids give us the ability to get a hold of a lot of mass, a lot of resources to start to build out a cislunar economy. That is an economy between the Earth and the Moon. And that could only help our Mars and other efforts elsewhere in the solar system. I actually think it could accelerate everything.
There has been talk of asteroid mining. Most of that talk includes mining asteroids for rare earth minerals and bringing them back to Earth.
Yeah,
and that is not what this book is about.
Not at all. If what we're trying to do here is expand human presence to build a platform and an economy on which we can stand and operate while we perhaps help fix Earth's climate, that means we need resources up there. And asteroids are already up there. They contain everything from nitrogen, ammonia, oxygen, iron, nickel, all of the resources we need. And they contain it by many, many, many millions of tons. And if we go into deep space and start to build O'Neill cylinders and large constructs in space, and we learn how to build our own biome, we'll be solving basically the problems of the human species, period.
What is it going to take for all of this to become real and within, let's just say, this 12-year window?
In terms of money, I mean, right now, NASA's budget is about $21 billion, I believe, and that's, of course, recently increased. And we spend routinely tens and hundreds of billions of dollars on things that, quite frankly, often just make things worse. Imagine if we, on an annual basis, started putting that level of investment into space, what we could achieve. Economic development, you know, new jobs, new industries. That would be an exciting future, something to work towards. And I think young people in particular yearn for that. They want that meta-narrative of things can get better, not just worse.
In this book, you have these seven space barons. You know, one is clearly Elon Musk.
Yeah,
the others are
I'm not saying anything. I think they're just any resemblance to real world people is purely coincidental, I assure you.
There is an existing book called Space Barons. People are really exploring this idea that these billionaires
are space titans in my book.
Space titans, exactly. So these
completely
that
different.
These billionaire space titans are going to push forward this vision.
And take tremendous risks in doing so.
Is that what it takes? Is there a version of great man or maybe ideally great woman theory at work here?
it is going to be sovereign missions of exploration, but also commercial. And there will be some friction between those two things. Let's face it, a big question to ask is, would it be okay for a private company to be the first one to land on Mars? In other words, would that upset nations, people, that a company would do it? There's many different questions. Would we allow people to mine? These are big legal questions that have to be explored. And of course, what value system, what legal system we bring into space, this is going to be very, very heady territory, and it's going to happen very quickly. So I think it's going to be the billionaire types who will be challenging all of these accepted conventions. Nations of the world are going to have to get together and come to some determination to hash things out. And it will be an interesting thing to watch. And again, I think these people will be bringing rapid change, and that might be good.
Daniel Suarez is the author of the new book, Delta V. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You heard him mention an O'Neill cylinder. That's an idea for a rotating space colony from the 1970s, proposed by scientist Gerard O'Neill. And billionaire space titan Jeff Bezos is into that idea, too. At an event this month for his space company Blue Origin, Bezos also proposed moving millions of people to colonies clustered in Earth's orbit. He said Earth's resources are finite, and while he didn't specifically say climate change, he said pollution is a growing problem. This final note before we go, those of us of normal means didn't pay much attention to a provision in last year's tax overhaul that let taxpayers immediately write off 100% of the cost of a private airplane bought between 2017 and 2027. Well, the private jet industry noticed. The Financial Times reports that the tax cuts have stopped a 10-year decline in prices on new and secondhand private jets. The average price of the most popular plane models is up 2% to $6.4 million.
Marketplace is supported by BitSight. From the back office to the boardroom, BitSight helps companies continuously manage cyber risk using its security ratings platform. More at BitSight.com. And by Figure, providing a streamlined digital platform for home equity loans. You can learn how to use the equity in your home for home improvement, major purchases, or debt consolidation at figure.com. Figure is now available in 37 states.
That's it, everybody. Markets were closed for the Memorial Day holiday. They'll be open as usual tomorrow. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. I'm Molly Wood. Don't worry, Kai's back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.